Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Jonah Goose, the young congressman from Colorado, is only entering his third year in Congress, and yet he's already begun to make his mark. The son of African immigrants has emerged as one of the notable young leaders in Washington. His eloquence was on full display during the recent impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. I sat down with Goose this week to talk about some breaking news and try to learn more about him. Here's that conversation. Congressman Joe Goose, it's good to meet you. You are suddenly a nationally known figure by dint of your work on the impeachment as an impeachment manager in the Senate. But you've got a great story, and I'm really eager to explore it. In addition to the issues of that experience raises, so welcome.
Well, thank you, David. It's a real pleasure for me. It's so nice to meet you, and glad to be on your podcast.
Tell me about your family history. You referenced it in your oratory and your presentations during that impeachment trial, and you've talked about it elsewhere. But I don't know that people know that much about your family and their history. Share to me your parents' experience. You're a second term congressman and a first generation American. So tell me about their journey from Eritrea.
Yeah, sure. Well, you're right. So I, I'm a proud Coloradan. I've lived in Colorado almost all my life, but my parents' story, my family story, like so many other Americans, is an immigrant story. My folks came here to the United States over 40 years ago as refugees from a small country in East Africa called Eritrea, which at the time was in a civil war with Ethiopia. They came to the United States, were welcomed here with open arms, many in the Eritrean community.
Tell me what you know of their experience there. What, there were two civil wars in short sequence there, and obviously Ethiopia was involved in all of this. But tell me what that meant for their lives there. What stories did they share with you about their lives and what caused them to leave?
Yeah, as you referenced, Eritrea, it was a 30-year war of independence. Essentially, Eritrea had been annexed as part of Ethiopia back in the early 60s. And so a 30-year war of independence ensued that ultimately, concluded with Eritrea, being its own country in the early 90s. They both left Eritrea at a fairly young age. They were... my dad was in his 20s and mom was in her late teens, and they came over separately. They didn't know each other. They met the Eritrean community at that time. Eritrean refugees were being admitted to, various different countries all over the world. I have cousins and family members that live in countries like Germany and England and France. And in the United States, there were many Eritreans who settled in California, Washington State, New York. My parents were both in California, so they actually met in a small town called Bakersfield, California, and that's where I was born, and where my sister was born. She's a year younger than me. We both lived there until I was about 6 years old when my dad was transferred for a job to Colorado. So, my dad, he went to school at Cal State Bakersfield in California. He became an accountant. My mom was a bank teller. They worked incredibly hard to make sure that, me and my sister could have the kind of opportunities that they could never dream of.
Do you still have relatives there?
Yeah. Most of my relatives are there.
When you went back, I know you went back on a Codel in 2019 as a congressman. Have you been back much to Eritrea?
I have not. You know, I had been back as a child early, I think when I was 11 or 12, and then once more when I was 17. But, you know, since then had not gone back until the Codel that you mentioned, which was a Codel to Ethiopia, but we also did a visit with Chairwoman Bass to Eritrea for, you know, about less than a day, essentially. But I have not. I've been back regularly.
That must have been something, though, to go back. I mean, here you are, a first-generation American. I know I felt that when I traveled with the president to Eastern Europe as his senior advisor, how moving it was to think about in one generation that he and his family fled, you know, violence and tyranny and came here with hope. And there I was standing next to the president of the United States in Red Square, listening to the national anthem, our national anthem, being played by the Russian Army band. And it was moving to think about what they sacrificed and what their hopes were. And that, you know, just one generation later, I could be in that position. And you must have felt some of that when you went back.
I did. You know, it's interesting. I'm sure this had the same impact on you, David. I watched Judge Garland's, well, Attorney General designate Garland, I should say, his testimony before the Judiciary Committee. And when he talked about his, you know, family's journey and their, you know, coming into the United States, and given his background and his immigrant background, his deep desire to pay it forward and to pay back this country that, you know, he really felt like he owed a debt to, that resonated with me, and I suspect with many others across our country. And so, yes, I think in that, you know, that trip for me, if anything, underscored the real promise of America. I mean, the notion that my parents could come to the United States with very, very little and sacrifice so much that only one generation removed, 40 years later, their son could serve in the United States House of Representatives. I legitimately believe, I don't think that that's possible in any other country in the world. It is unique to the United States. And so it matters a great deal to me. And I think it's reflective of America at its best, right? Honoring the ideals of being able to welcome folks who seek refuge from across the globe. And obviously that was a principle that was deeply damaged under the prior administration and that we're finally beginning to recover now in the early days of the Biden administration. But yes, no, it was definitely a lot of feelings in that regard during that trip.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Ronald Reagan was president when your parents came over.
That's right.
And it was a much different, you know, our attitude toward refugees, or at least the government's attitude toward refugees, were much different than what we've seen in the last 4 years. It's become a polarizing issue. This must animate you in these debates, knowing your own family history and the contribution that you and your family have made to the country and so many other immigrants and refugees have made to this country. It literally is what keeps America young.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Ronald Reagan, many presidents, Republican and Democratic, have often talked about, our nation being a nation of immigrants. And as you said, keeping our country the dynamic, robust, young, hopeful, idealistic country that we are. And as I said, I think the last several years were deeply damaging to those principles that have guided our country so well and that have obviously played a defining role in my life and in my family's journey to this country. And it's one of the reasons why I decided to run for Congress, 3 years ago during the depths of the Trump administration, and seeing what he was doing with respect to immigration and feeling as though my voice might be one that could add some value to this particular debate.
There is a debate going on right now because President Biden is trying to reverse some of the policies of the last administration relative to immigration and many other things. One of your colleagues, Congressman Cuellar from Texas, said the other day that he was concerned, though, that handled wrong, you could have a replication of what we saw at the border in 2000. 2018, and in 2014, where a rush of people come, often being told that they could enter freely, and creating a huge problem. What are the challenges of reversing these policies, implementing a humane but, you know, predictable and regulated flow of refugees and immigrants?
Yeah, I think the words you used are key, David. Predictable, regular, secured, right? I mean, in my view, I have great respect for my colleague that you referenced, and there are no doubt a set of very complex technical issues around immigration enforcement and some of the decisions that will have to be made on our southern border. But I also think it's important for, you know, contextual purposes to remember, and you know this, but I think it can get lost sometimes on the American public, the night and day approach generally to immigration that this administration is pursuing versus the last one, right? I mean, the last administration just had no regard, I think, for the value that immigrants bring to the table and being a core part of our country and the melting pot that is the United States of America. And that is clearly not the case with respect to President Biden and the cabinet that he's assembled. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be some thorny, complex policy issues that, you know, the Department of Homeland Security is going to have to work out in consultation with Congress, and in particular with those lawmakers that represent districts on our southern border. And obviously immigration is a huge issue here in my state of Colorado. But a part of it, I would just say also, and you've been following these issues and active in them so long that I suspect you may agree, part of it is that Congress has largely abdicated its role as far as immigration regulation and immigration law is concerned. I serve on the Immigration Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, which used to be a very active committee. It largely responsible for writing the various immigration laws that we have on the books today, including the big reform that was passed during Ronald Reagan's presidency. We have not done much in the way of legislating. Immigration reform has been largely a matter for the executive to determine.
There's a reason for that. I mean, you say that the last administration didn't appreciate the value of immigrants. I think they appreciated the value of the issue of immigration, but in the opposite way. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump came down the escalator at Trump Tower, and the takeaway from that announcement speech was his virulent assault on immigration from Mexico. One of his first actions was the total ban on Muslims, or the ban on Muslims, I should say, entering the country. He ratcheted down refugees coming to this country and propagated the notion that, you know, these refugees were dangerous, that these immigrants were sucking down benefits and taking American jobs. And he found an audience for that. And I'm sure that as you talk to your colleagues, and I know that you have friends across the aisle in Congress, I mean, that is a powerful meme out there. And, you know, the reason that presidents have acted unilaterally on immigration is because Congress couldn't get it together to act on immigration. Each time an immigration reform was passed in one chamber of Congress, it was defeated. The other, the House defeated an immigration reform bill during the Obama administration, or wouldn't even take it up.
That's right. No, you're right. You're right. I mean, notwithstanding the broad consensus that at least used to exist amongst most folks in Congress around immigration reform and the contours of what a compromise might look like. Of course, that's been, as you said, completely eviscerated by virtue of politicians who, you know, choose to demagogue and use the issue of immigration to demonize certain parts of our population. And they've done that, you know, with great political effect, as you mentioned. Obviously, I think that's my hope is we could turn the page on that. But you're not. Perhaps I'm a bit naive. You're not wrong to suggest that maybe it's will nonetheless be difficult for Congress to get its act together in light of the powerful and potent political tool that this issue has developed into for a certain part of our political system, for some Republicans in Congress.
President Biden has actually come forth with a immigration reform plan. It's actually more aggressive in its reforms than previous proposals. But what's your candid assessment? I know you're endlessly optimistic, and I and I appreciate that. But I also know you're a shrewd politician and student of the Congress. I mean, what are the chances of passing that immigration bill through a House that is rather narrowly divided right now, and then through the Senate with the filibuster?
Yeah, I'd say sort of two separate questions, two separate answers. With respect to the first question, I actually think the answer is yes. I think we can get the president's immigration, the Citizenship Act of 2021 that Linda Sanchez is leading in the House. I think we can get it through the lower chamber. I really do. It's not to suggest that there aren't going to be some compromises and some, you know, revisions to the ultimate language that was introduced. But nonetheless, I think it is within sight. Now, that being said, the tougher answer is to the second question. And I, of course, am in the House, not the Senate. You have far more familiarity with the rules of the Senate than I do. But I think that's a tougher battle. I would say this, though. There does seem to be consensus emerging that if we're unable to get a comprehensive bill done, which, of course, has to be the central goal, it's my goal, and I think that's shared by certainly most in the House Democratic Caucus, we also have to be prepared to do as much as we can for as many people as we can, right? To do as much good as we are capable of doing within the political structure that exists in Washington, which means the Dream and Promise Act, which is a bipartisan bill, has Republican support in the House, and I think could very well muster sufficient votes to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. We ought not abandon that and that potential course of action. I have many dreamers in my district who I've met with. I actually, my first State of the Union, the first State of the Union rather that I'd ever attended as both a citizen and as a member of Congress was in 2019. And I brought as my first guest, as you know, members of the House have a guest that they can bring, a young dreamer named Elias, who's was a student at Colorado State University, brilliant young kid who, you know, is really known no other country but the United States as his home. He came here at a very young age, didn't know that he wasn't born in the United States until he had was applying for college. And, you know, I made a promise to him, and so did many others, that we would ensure we take every step we can to ensure that he has a place in this country that you know, we both are so lucky and blessed to call home. So I think we have to be prepared to move on whatever pieces or components of the legislation can garner a sufficient, you know, majority to get to the president's desk.
And there is broad public support for addressing this issue of the Dreamers, these young people who were brought here by their parents, as you say, have known no other country, are contributors, splendid students, some serve in the military. I mean, it's a very persuasive case. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. Even though you pose as a naive House member, you're a you're a student of the process, and you got a little taste of the process, which we'll talk about later when you spent a few days in the Senate earlier this year on the impeachment, where you had an even steeper number of votes necessary to achieve a conviction. But 60 votes is a lot of votes to get in the United States Senate. A lot of your colleagues and a lot of Democrats think the Democrat majority in the Senate should abolish the filibuster because it stands in the way of legislation like the immigration reform, like perhaps the minimum wage if it's not included in this reconciliation bill around COVID. Where are you on that?
It's a good question. It's a fair question. And I will answer it directly. However, I want to preface it with, I'm not trying to be obtuse or,
Well, if you preface it, then you're not answering it directly.
I think it's important.
No, I'm just kidding.
For your listeners, right, to know that it's a tough question. I don't think it's black and white. And I think there are reasonable arguments on both sides of this debate, right? I've been worried for a long time about the constitutional hardball that the leader, minority leader now, the former majority leader, in my view, had started years ago, and that has sort of created this race to the bottom. And there are reasonable arguments
about Mitch McConnell.
By people that I respect. I'm talking about Mitch McConnell. Yes, reasonable arguments by people I respect who have, you know, made the case that to move forward on the course that you described would have collateral consequences down the road that would not, you know, inure to the benefit of the people that we represent. All that being said, I will say it this way. I in August had the opportunity to travel to Atlanta, and it's my first trip to Ebenezer Baptist Church to mourn the loss of John Lewis, who, of course, you know well.
Yes.
A treasured colleague and, you know, a giant among giants. And
yeah,
President
man.
Obama, your former boss, you know, spoke and gave just a brilliant eulogy. And to sit there in those pews and listen to our country's first Black president, someone who had inspired me and so many others to pursue public service, to hear him articulate the reasons why, perhaps obliquely, that, you know, why we potentially need to be prepared to push aside the filibuster for something as important as the Voting Rights Act, which is, you know, structural in terms of our democracy. That argument appeals to me. I mean, I do think the filibuster is in need of reform. What type of reform? I think that is a more, you know, a tougher question, and a question that probably merits more conversation than the time we have. But that's where I live.
Yeah, on the Voting Rights Act, because I wanted to get back to the thread of your own story. But on the Voting Rights Act, you've had, you know, hundreds of pieces of legislation introduced in states across the country, almost entirely by Republicans, after this 2020 election, that to roll back early voting, to roll back same day registration, to toughen voter ID laws, all of which appear to be aimed at reducing voter participation, something I know you've worked on all your life. Do you anticipate this Voting Rights Act moving quickly here? And is that going to be the flare point over a potential fight on the filibuster?
I think that that's correct. I think the Voting Rights Act and H.R. 1 will both pass the House in short order. And I think that both of them will serve in large part as the flare point, as you described it, I think, accurately, for this question, and that we're going to have to resolve it one way or the other. And obviously, you know, that's going to be a question that the Senate House Democratic Caucus has to kind of resolve, but ultimately a question that the American people are going to, you know, be resolving as well. So I think that sequencing is probably right.
One last question on this whole procedural thing, because it is important. It's meaningful if legislation can or can't pass the United States Senate. But there's a lot of pressure on the vice president right now, Kamala Harris, to overrule the Senate parliamentarian and allow a vote on the $15 minimum wage, something I know you fought for in this reconciliation bill. Are you among those who believe that she should overrule a parliamentarian? Should she use her chair? It doesn't seem like the administration's that eager for that to happen.
Ultimately, where I landed on that, I have great respect for many of my colleagues who, you know, believe passionately that the presiding officer, which in this case could be the vice president, should exercise her discretion in that way. I think on balance, my sense was that I'm not in a position to tell the vice president of the United States what to do in that regard. That decision is something that a decision she's going to have to reach in consultation with the Senate Majority Leader, with the budget chairman, Senator Sanders, and others to make a conclusion about what works best. Again, I guess I would just also caution that these decisions we make today will have consequences tomorrow. And so it's not to suggest that I'm not supportive of doing everything we can to make sure the minimum wage is part of the reconciliation bill. I have been an advocate for that for a long time. But I think
you ran on it. Yeah,
it's worth at least taking a step back and considering it. And it may be that on balance, balancing the equities, the conclusion is reached that she should reverse or not reverse, rather, but disregard the advisory opinion by the parliamentarian. But that'll ultimately be a decision up to the vice president, Majority Leader Schumer, and Senator Sanders, and the others in the caucus.
You know, it strikes me that she is in a really difficult spot, not just on this, but generally, because though, you know, no one would say at this point that President Biden won't run for re-election, the chances are at 82 that he might not. That makes her the putative kind of front runner for that office. So in a sense, everything that he does that irritates some faction within the party, and you know the most active faction within the party are progressives, goes on her account and not his. And it seems to me that's a very tough spot for her, because she, I'm sure, wants to be a loyal and useful partner to him, as he was to President Obama. You know, she's got pressures that he didn't have.
Well, you know, I prefaced this in the beginning, as I said, you've won two presidential campaigns, a senatorial campaign, and many others. I am but a two-term House member, so my views on the political, prognosis of the vice president, in a future election, are probably not yours. I trust yours far better than my own. But I hear you. I mean, you're not, what you're saying is certainly not. I think it's fair to, to kind of assess the situation as it stands today. I think part of my frustration has been the bill that we passed on Friday, and I was in the House when we, voted on that at 2 a.m. in the morning. It is, and the whole package. You know this from your time during the Obama administration, right? It is almost double, or a little over double, the stimulus bill that was approved at the depths of the Great Recession in 2009. There is a lot of very positive, substantive provisions, there are in this bill that will do a lot of good for the people of our country. And I just would hope that, the public can recognize all that this bill entails and the ways in which I think it's going to provide an economic lifeline to a lot of people. Not to minimize the conversation around the pieces.
Even if it doesn't include the minimum wage.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, right? 25% of this bill, roughly over $400 billion of it, it constitutes the direct stimulus checks, the $1,400 checks that many Americans, hardworking Americans, are going to receive in just a few weeks once the bill is signed by the president, right? It includes massive investments that would cut childhood poverty, child tax credits that people like my senator, Senator Michael Bennett, have been working on for essentially his entire career. So there's a lot in this bill to be proud of. I'm going to continue to push for the minimum wage. I would hope that the Senate would use, every avenue that they can pursue to get it done. But I'm also, not going to presuppose that I tell them how to run the Senate.
I think that was deft. A deft answer to a difficult question. I agree with you. I mean, I think, look, governing is filled with frustration. Democracy is, it demands compromise. Compromise is not a word that people like to hear, but democracy demands it. And if what you get, every president I know has said the same thing: if I can get 80% of what I want, I'm taking that deal. And I'm sure President Biden feels the same way, especially given the crisis the country faces. Let's return to your story, because you mentioned that your folks moved when you were 6 years old to Colorado. You settled down in a town called Highlands Ranch, Colorado. And I'm wondering what that was like for you. Highlands Ranch is an area that I would guess 90% white, and probably certainly was that much when you were there. So you, tell me what it was like for you as a young child of immigrants, a person of color, in the schools when you were a kid.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you mentioned, we settled in Highlands Ranch. We lived in a number of different places when we moved initially to Colorado. But and Colorado is a state, as I'm sure you know, and you've been here many times before. It's roughly 80% white. The congressional district that I represent now, today, is about 1% black. So the statewide population of African Americans is roughly 4%. It's not a particularly diverse community, as you mentioned. But look, I'd say for me, growing up in Colorado, and not just with respect to Highlands Ranch, but also just in general, and the communities that I call home today and have represented in Congress and have been living in for the last 20 or 18 years, have been very inclusive, tolerant communities. Colorado, and again, I suspect you may agree, having traveled to the state so many times, it's a state where people are, generally very, there's sort of this Westerner ethos, right, of live and let live and not, I think, judging folks, books by their cover and being a kind of community that welcomes folks across, who have different, come from different walks of life. So again, not to suggest that There aren't hurdles that you face as an immigrant, in the case of my parents, or as a son of immigrants, or as a person of color. There certainly are. But I've been really lucky and blessed to live in a community that has really welcomed me.
You didn't experience any sense of being the other or being separate from other kids when you were growing up in that town?
Every person's going to have those experiences. I'm not going to tell you that there aren't times when I've felt that way, throughout the course of my life. But no, on balance, I think, as I've said, my experience has been a positive one.
Yeah, well, you also, you talked earlier about giving back and working hard and so on. I mean, your story, you couldn't write a more inspiring story, academic excellence, class president, University of Colorado, more of the same. You really early on got into, you were attracted to politics, you were attracted to student governance, but also interned with the Speaker of the House in Colorado. What attracted you to that?
Neither of my parents are lawyers or politicians, nor any, anybody in my extended family. I at a very early age, I knew that I wanted to pursue public service. Any number of reasons why. I mean, one, I just being in student government, the most simplistic way, I enjoyed kind of leading a team and trying to, problem solve with a group of people who might be very different than me, right? And of course, given the community that I grew up in, that was generally always the case. And I found that kind of work really interesting and motivating, right? To try to convince folks who might have completely different worldviews than your own to join together for a common purpose, whatever that purpose might be. And I got involved in student government when I was in college and worked for a while for the Speaker of the House at the Colorado Legislature, which really kind of opened my eyes to the legislative process, and then ran for the Board of Regents when I was in law school and was elected to the board.
Statewide position.
Congressional district. So it was the same congressional district that I represent now in the Congress, the 2nd District. And that experience was the year that, of course, President Obama was elected in 2008. And it was just an exciting time.
You're 24 years old.
Yes, it was 24. Got elected in 2008 and served on the board for 6 years. Again, really incredible work for me. I mean, I enjoyed it. It was, trying to develop coalitions amongst a board. It's essentially Colorado's higher education board, but it's unlike most states elected. In most states, those boards are appointed by the governor. But in Colorado and 3 other states, the members are elected. And so, in serving in that capacity was the first opportunity I had to meet President Obama, which was an experience that I'll never forget. I've been lucky.
I remember the first time I met him too.
I think your experience.
It was a good experience for me also. Yeah, it was a good experience for me also. Hey, I don't want to beat this to death, but it interests me. When I had Sanjay Gupta on the podcast sometime last year during the, to talk about the COVID crisis, but also his own life. And Sanjay, like yourself, was a stellar student. He's also from an immigrant family, I should say, stellar student. And he said he joined everything and he wanted to be a part of everything because he felt that was the way to be accepted. That was the way to feel like he was really part of everything, which he said he didn't always feel. And I was just wondering if there was something of that in your motivation as well.
Yeah, no, for me, it was, to be candid, I mean, not so much that, although I understand what the doctor is saying. Honestly, it was much more, again, the value that my parents had instilled in me and my sister, that we were very lucky, because unlike so many of our family members, it's akin to winning the lottery, right? We had the privilege of being born in the United States of America, where you can be anything you want to be if you work hard enough and you have the freedoms and the opportunities to live your dreams. And they very much, it was, this very important in our household and to my parents. And I credit them to the extent I've had any success, it's been because of them, because they, it was very important to them early on. And so that, for whatever reason, it instilled, I think, in me this sort of sense that I would try to, you know, to be active participant in, you know, a variety of different public service endeavors and to, you know, to take advantage of those opportunities to play a role, because those are opportunities that a lot of people in the world don't have. There are many places in the world where there is no right to vote. There's no right to run for public office.
You didn't just seize opportunities, but you created them. You started a group with some others called New Era Colorado while you were a student in between, I guess, college and law school. The purpose of which was to really, and I'm, this is near and dear to my heart because I'm the director of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, which has a similar mission, but to engage and empower students, not just to vote, but to be civically active. And that's had quite a bit of success.
Yeah, it was, I mean, an incredibly exciting endeavor. Myself and some colleagues of mine had decided that we just thought that the conventional structures for getting involved politically really weren't available to young people, right? You know, it's not easy for a young person to go become a precinct committee person within one of the political parties, right? That's just not a system that's particularly, structured in a way that attracts young people. And so our thought was, why not create an organization that was purely focused on getting young people more involved in politics, more involved civically, irrespective of one's own political preferences, right? For us, it wasn't, you know, it doesn't matter if you're voting Republican or Democratic. We just wanted young people to vote and to register to vote. And that if they did that, they'd be far more inclined, public officials would be far more inclined to focus in on issues that young people care about. So yeah, the organization was started with one employee who's a friend of mine who now is the Senate Majority Leader in the State Senate here in Colorado. And, it blossomed into an organization that's registered, I think, over 165,000 young people across the state, helped shepherd some of the most important reforms early on in terms of online voter registration, pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. So, yeah, very exciting. And, glad that we were able to hand the reins off long ago, I must say, because we started the organization and then kind of let other young people take the lead.
But it's still functioning.
It is, yeah, to this day. It's still functioning. I left the organization, I think, a long time ago, over a decade ago. But it continues to this day.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You practiced law, but you also ran in 2014 for Secretary of State, which is a statewide position, obviously, in Colorado. And you came awfully close. You lost by 2 points.
As you'll remember.
Yeah, it was a tough year for Democrats. Yes, I remember it very well.
Yeah, it was, similar to when I ran for regent, I thought that I could help make a difference in that particular role that I was running for at the time. We had a Secretary of State that I believed was creating more hurdles for folks to be able to ultimately register and be able to participate in the electoral process. So I tossed my hat in the ring and spent the better part of a year and a half traveling our wonderful state and came awfully close, as you said. It was the year, of course, that we lost control of the United States Senate, and Senator Udall here in Colorado lost his election, as did every other person running for a constitutional office, with the exception of our governor. I made a lot of friends in the process, including the individual who ultimately beat me, who became the Republican Secretary of State and who remains a good friend to this day. It was a fascinating race, and obviously I learned a lot on that campaign.
Yeah, and the fact that you did so well under, as you point out, in a bad Democratic year does speak to Colorado's receptivity to diverse candidates, talented diverse candidates. I when you said that before, I thought, well, I also ought to point out that you have a congresswoman from your state who is a QAnon adherent and came to the House chambers with a gun. So, tolerance, that doesn't bespeak tolerance, and it does speak to the fact that you have it is a diverse state, and there are pockets of deep conservatism there. And so you're a sunny side up guy, but I think it's worth pointing out because these are the divisions that we have in our country.
That's true. No, we're a microcosm of America, right? But I, as you said, I'm a sunny side guy, and I tend to focus in on, you know, in the last 4 years, Colorado elected its first gay governor, one of only two gay governors serving in the United States, Jared Polis, who was my predecessor in Congress, and elected the state's first Black congressman when I was elected 2 years, or 3 years ago now. So, yeah, I mean, as you said, I am sunny side up to a fault, I suppose. But we are a very diverse state, and it's not to suggest that there aren't deep divisions that we have to work through. There certainly are.
And the story continues, extraordinary story. When you were 31, you were appointed the director of the State Department of Regulatory Affairs. And just to be clear, that includes the Civil Rights Division in the state, the Office of Consumer Counsel, and the Public Utilities Commission. So quite a portfolio, 600 employees. That was a big role for someone who really hadn't managed a large organization before.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. As you said, the agencies that are included as part of the Department of Regulatory Agencies, kind of an obscure sounding name for the department, but you know, it's essentially the counterpart to the CFPB or the SEC at the federal level. And they do incredibly important work, you know, protecting consumers every day, you know, pushing to make sure that the little guy, right, is protected here in Colorado. Whether it's insurance complaints or regulating the banks and so forth. And it was incredibly enlightening for me to be able to have that experience of managing an agency with 600 employees and, you know, developing a team and trying to, again, push towards a common agenda. And I will be forever grateful to Governor Hickenlooper, who, you know, gave me that opportunity, appointed me his cabinet.
Here, you can walk across the rotunda and thank him anytime you want. Now,
well, that's, so. I see him more often now than I have you know, in a few years, of course, saw him more often when I was in his cabinet. But yes, now that he's Senator Hickenlooper, we have another opportunity to partner with each other. But no, I had met him during the course of campaigning across the state when I was running for Secretary of State. And so when he called and offered me this opportunity, I thought that it would be a great way to serve the state. And so decided to take it. But, it was not part of any kind of careful plan, I should say. You know, you don't really run for Congress by, you know, running for regent and then, becoming DORA director.
The question really is, you've now had a taste of managing, of being an executive and a legislator, and I'm wondering which appeals to you more?
I have enjoyed both jobs tremendously.
I knew you were going to say that.
But I will say there's something unique about managing a large agency, and the ability to, we have a wonderful team in my congressional office of staff who work tremendously hard and the same principles apply in terms of, developing a common purpose and pushing towards that, that purpose and achieving it. But again, something very unique when you're managing that large of an agency, it's incredibly exciting and you learn a lot. And so, yeah, it's a tough question, but I think that's probably where I tend to.
Well, it's one you're going to probably have to confront at some point as your career advances here, because there'll be opportunities on both the executive and the legislative side. Let's talk about the thing that brought you to really national attention in the last month, and that was the events of January 6th and the impeachment that followed. First of all, tell me a little bit. I know you were one of the designees who fought off these challenges to the Electoral College. And so you were deeply engaged that day before the insurrection broke out. Tell me what that experience was like. You were in the middle of debate when all hell broke loose.
Yeah, as you said, I was on the floor with my friend Jamie Raskin and Chairman Schiff and Chairwoman Lofgren as we were leading the opposition to the objections that were made by some of our colleagues. And so I was very focused on that, to be candid, and was not fully aware as to kind of what was happening outside of the Capitol. It wasn't really until I started receiving, some alarming texts from folks and from my wife, and then, sort of rapid succession of seeing the Speaker of the House and others, the Majority Leader, being escorted from the House, and then, the police and Sergeant at Arms announcing to the House chamber that the rioters had breached the the Capitol, and you know, we're in the Capitol Rotunda, and that tear gas had been deployed, and that we needed to retrieve our tear gas masks and just in case, and you know, prepare to take cover. And then we were evacuated, and you know, it just was a very
well. At what point did you say, "Holy shit, this is really dangerous"? We're in the line of fire here.
Yeah, it was after they had announced that tear gas had been deployed in the Capitol Rotunda, and that we needed to retrieve our tear gas masks. And at that point, and the chaplain at some point there offered a prayer. You know, my wife texted me that these insurrectionists were in Statuary Hall, which, as you know, the Capitol complex fairly well, but that's right, you know, outside the House chamber. So once that happened, you know, a combination of those different events, it was very clear to me that things had gone terribly wrong. You think about the trauma that the country experienced that day, and that everybody in the House gallery up above, or you know, in different parts of the Capitol complex experienced. It's still to this day, I think, has been a traumatic thing for a lot of people.
Yeah, you have a 2.5-year-old child, so that adds a dimension, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I texted my wife and you know told her that I loved her and our daughter very much, and you know told her everything would be fine. And many of us, I mean, it's interesting, you know, in Congress, I suspect, although I haven't looked at the empirical data, that there are more young parents today serving in Congress than there have been in recent memory. Certainly many of my closest friends in Congress are members on both sides of the aisle who have, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds. And so, yeah, obviously that's another dimension. I will say this, I can't say enough good things, as I know so much of the country agrees, about the Capitol Police officers who, you know, really put themselves on the line. I mean, they just were so courageous to evacuate us and to protect folks, staff, everybody at the Capitol. It's really tremendous.
That was just the beginning for you, because that set the impeachment in motion. First of all, let me ask you a question about impeachment. You actually were one of the early people calling for President Trump to be impeached. I mean, early in your time in Washington. You may even said it during your campaign. I don't know. Did the early suggestions that Trump should be impeached on other grounds make this at all more complicated? Do you regret having said that then, because it became a mantra for Republicans who were defending the president, that this was just a fetish of Democrats?
No. Look, in 2019, I served on the House Judiciary Committee. There were many of us who ultimately called for an impeachment inquiry to begin after it was clear that the president was going to obstruct Congress in such a way that was unprecedented, right? And that the real kind of focal point at that point was when he refused to have Don McGahn testify in front of the Judiciary Committee, right? Which was just, again, unprecedented in terms of prior presidential misconduct.
This was in the Russia probe. Yeah,
that's right. Precisely. And I'd also say this, I think in some respects, the breaking of the norms that he was engaged in throughout his presidency, kind of, it made clear that the writing was on the wall, that perhaps this would be the culmination, right? What the final norm that he would undermine would be the peaceful transfer of power, which of course was what happened on January 6th. So you can draw a line.
Yeah, you definitely can. I mean, look, the Ukraine caper was really an effort to try and derail Biden, who he feared as a candidate. And so, as many others have said, there was an effort to try and cheat on the front end and an effort to try and overturn the results in the back end. So there is a straight line. But tell me what it was like those 27 days of preparation and execution of the impeachment team.
Yeah, it was an eventful few weeks. I mean, it was very intense in terms of the preparation, and spent a great deal of time with my fellow managers and others, you know, our staff counsel, our lawyers, developing the arguments and deciding on the presentation of evidence and preparing our case. And then, of course, the trial itself, you know, you feel the weight of history standing in the well of the United States Senate. And it was, you know, I was honored. It was humbling. And obviously, I had hoped for a different outcome. And we all believed, very much legitimately believed, that there was a possibility to get to 67 votes. And lead manager Raskin felt that. I felt that. All of my colleagues, we felt that was within reach, just given the strength of the evidence. And obviously, you know, again, understanding the political winds as they were, but nonetheless, feeling as though if the senators looked at this in an impartial and objective way, they had to come to the same conclusion that Liz Cheney had come to. And so, you know,
really big if, though.
Well, it's a really big if. You are right. That's clearly.
You got more votes for conviction from the president's own party than ever in history in any impeachment.
That's correct. It was the most bipartisan impeachment vote, impeachment vote, right? Acquittal vote in this case, but in the history of presidential impeachments. And, you know, the fact that, that multiple senators chose to, you know, choose their country over party and did the right thing, I think was a vindication of our decision to proceed.
Tell me about Jamie Raskin, because he tragically lost his son in the midst of this. I mean, I guess it was the day before, a few days before New Year's Eve, so a few days before the insurrection. And then he was called upon to lead this process. And my editorial judgment was brilliantly, but geez, that must have been hard. How did he interact with all of you around all of that?
I mean, one, Jamie's a dear, close personal friend, one of my closest friends in the Congress. We served together in House leadership. We served together on the Judiciary Committee. And he's just a kind, decent man. He is someone who is universally liked by Republican and Democratic members of the Congress. And his leadership style is very much an egalitarian style. It's very inclusive, which was really important. And I think ultimately endeared him to every member of our team and ultimately to the country as were able to see our presentation of the evidence. He was disciplined. He was focused. He kept us on task. And I thought he did a phenomenal job. I don't know where he found the strength to do something as hard as this was, while simultaneously mourning such a tragic loss. He's a courageous guy.
I recommend to anybody who hasn't read his tribute, the tribute he and his wife wrote
to
their
tremendous.
Son,
yeah, to
Tommy.
Yeah.
Tommy was one of the most wrenching and beautiful things that I've ever read. Any parent and anyone with a beating heart would be moved by it. When you talked to your guy, you saw Mitch McConnell, who essentially affirmed your case and then clung to an argument that became a life raft for a lot of Republicans, that you couldn't convict a president who already left office. When you talk to your colleagues, I mean, are people candid with you about the pressures that they faced?
Yes. Oh, certainly. In the House, not so much, I have as many conversations with senators, but yeah, in the House, colleagues are some of them are honest about the unique pressures that they face. Look, you know this, David, the way in which redistricting has been performed in various states, it has created a situation where you have districts that are so heavily gerrymandered that, the incentive structure is such that they take great political risk at, voting in a way that's inconsistent with the views of their constituency. And of course, you see this materializing, right, for the 10 who voted to impeach in the House.
Yeah, Trump read the roll at CPAC yesterday.
That's right.
Every single person who voted against him and basically put a target on their back. Speaking of targets, one of the really sad pieces of this is that everyone involved becomes a target and their families become targets. Have there been security issues that you've had to face as a result of your participation in this process?
There have. I don't talk about it publicly, and so I don't know that I would hear. But we are in an environment now that's so deeply polarized, and passions are running so high that it is disappointing that we've gotten to a place in our politics where people have to fear for their own personal safety or the safety of their families. But
yeah, disappointment. I mean, how about scary?
Yeah, scary is the right word, perhaps the better word. But yeah, we're grateful to local law enforcement and the Capitol Police and others who have worked with us and with other managers and with other, I suspect, Republican members of Congress who, by the way, have had a far greater challenge in terms of dealing with these kinds of issues, as you can imagine, voting to impeach as they did, that those 10 Republicans who, as you said, were subject to the roll call that the former president made yesterday.
Although they referred to him as the current president. But one of the manifestations of your talent, your political talent, and the regard with which your colleagues hold, in which your colleagues hold you, is that you are now part of the leadership team in the House. There's been a lot said about the Republicans and the civil war that's going on within the Republican Party. Tell me about the dynamics within the Democratic Party. And, you know, you have your, you're quite progressive, and yet you seem to travel in two worlds. But there's been a division between moderates in the House, a lot of them from suburban areas like yours, representatives from, you know, AOC and others from solidly Democratic, mostly urban districts. Tell me about those dynamics and how you bridge those.
Yeah, I'd say this, two things. One, to anyone who wonders whether the divisions, to the extent there are any, within the Democratic Party are as salient as those in the Republican Party, I'd point them to the press conference that the minority leader, Mr. McCarthy, had with the conference chair, which I'm sure you saw, Representative Cheney.
That was awkward.
I would encourage people to then watch the press conferences of House Democratic leadership. And I think that they will find that, look, there are disagreements over policy, right? The Democratic Party is a big tent party. We have, from both ends of the spectrum, a lot of different ideological views across that spectrum as to, you know, different matters of public policy. And that's good. That's healthy. I think that that's reflective of a party that's competing in a lot of different places in the country. And we ought to welcome that. I think people would be surprised that some of the members you just mentioned in the Democratic caucus that they are close friends with some of the most conservative or moderate members of the House Democratic caucus. And I say that as someone who knows the former freshman class, we're now sophomores, but the class of 2018, really well, including our progressive members and also those members from really tough competitive districts. And again, I know that from personal experience. Not saying that there aren't big differences, but
that's going to be good because with a very, very narrow margin and a lot of ambitions for legislation, I suspect that you're going to be doing a lot of diplomatic missions between now and 2022 among your colleagues, but because diversity is a great thing, but it brings with it its own challenges, and those are challenges for leadership, and you are on that track. Jonah Goose, it's really great to be with you, great to meet you. I suspect this is just the first of many conversations that we'll have, and I, like many others, will be watching what you do next.
Well, the pleasure was all mine, David. It's nice to talk to you and to meet you as well. And I appreciate you having me on the program.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.